Hi, this is Thomas Smith of Atheistically Speaking, and you're listening to Inciting Incident, because rationality should not be the exception.
It's Sunday, and it's 7 p.m., which means it's time for the Inciting Incident podcast, supported by our patrons, and available on Libsyn, Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Android, LiveJournal, Google+, The Hard Harry Show, News Radio, WHP 580, Rock and Emily's Bed Radios that are somehow appropriate for children that age, most tin cans connected with string, Tumblr, Snapchat, Zanga, LimeWire, WinMX, Napster, although we'll have to spell it with two Y's there to escape Big Brother, the DCI, the Enchantment Under the Sea Dance, the Plate and Pete and Pete's Mother's Head, and any other podcast app that somehow escaped this list. And now, here's your host, Al Lehman.
Good evening. This is your host, Al Lehman, back again with the same guest for the second recording of the first time. This is Al Lehman. Joining me is Tim O'Neill from History for Atheists. Welcome back for the second time.
Good morning.
Indeed. Even though it's about 5, 6 in the afternoon here, it's morning where you are. So just to fill you in case you missed it, Tim and I recorded last Friday, and as we always do in the Technical Difficulties podcast, Google decided to erase our entire conversation. So we're going to have a conversation here that somewhat mirrors the one we had last week, and we're going to pretend like I haven't heard some of these answers before. So we're in for a treat. Tim, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then we'll get started on the history nerdery and see where it goes.
Okay, so I've got deja vu already. So yeah, look, I suppose just a bit about me and my background. My background is, I'm an atheist. I've been an atheist for many years, all my adult life, and I suppose I came to atheism through history. So a great many people come to atheism, I suppose, through science and or maybe philosophy. But in my case, I was raised a Christian, not a terribly fanatical one, but came from a Christian family but had a great passion for, even back then in my late teens, had a great passion for ancient history and medieval history. And so I suppose I found myself looking at my faith and thinking, well, if I get challenged on the historical basis for this, I'd like to be able to answer those questions. So what I did was I started looking at the historical basis for Christianity, and was quite confident that I would be able to back up my beliefs, and I was wrong. The more I examined the claims that Christianity makes about Jesus, the less likely they seemed, and eventually I came to the conclusion that Jesus wasn't God in human form. He was simply a Jewish preacher. And I suppose I've kind of gone from there. I still have a great fascination for ancient medieval history. I still have a great fascination for the history of early Christianity and for the origins of Christianity. And I've got this real interest in examining history, not sort of accepting what most people believe as a result of that, I suppose. So that's where my skepticism began, and that's also where my analysis of the historical origins of things began as well. What happened was a few years ago when what we could loosely call New Atheism started to pop up with the publication of books by people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens, I found as an atheist that it was interesting that suddenly atheism, which had been kind of this nerdy thing that I was into before, was suddenly it was flavor of the month. And I thought that was great. And I started hanging out on a lot of the atheist web boards and discussion groups and so on that popped up. What I found, though, as someone who was, you know, in the broader sense of the word, a historian, was that a lot of my fellow atheists were making arguments against Christianity based on a grasp of history which was wrong. So a lot of people were taking commonly held, commonly believed ideas about history and using them to argue against Christianity. So they were saying things like Christianity caused the Dark Ages. They were saying things like Christians in the Middle Ages burned scientists at the stake and suppressed science. They were saying things like the Great Library of Alexandria was burned down by Christians because they hated science and knowledge. And this stuff is all crap. And so I suppose what I was trying, I found myself saying, guys, no, that's not actually true. And then something very interesting started to happen. I found that there were a great many atheists, when I pointed out these errors and showed them the evidence that these things were wrong, who began arguing against me the way fundamentalists do.
Right, so there are some of the commonly held myths that we like to believe, like Galileo. I know that's one we talked about before, and we'll get deja vu again about talking about. But, you know, so you had atheists who were being fundamentalist about history and being as closed-minded as atheists tend to accuse religious people of being from a different direction, right?
Yeah, ironically, yeah. Obviously not all. And there were a great many, obviously there were a great many atheists who one, knew what I was saying and knew that it was correct, and then others who looked at the evidence and accepted that yeah, okay, maybe those commonly held ideas are wrong. But what worried me and what continues to worry me, and the reason why I started the blog History for Atheists, is that I keep coming across atheists who are dogmatically committed to these historical myths, and others who and people who are also dogmatically committed to fringe pseudo-historical ideas that most scholars simply reject, such as the idea that Jesus didn't exist. There was no historical Jesus at all. And it worries me that people who, like us, who talk about being rational and talk about checking your facts and talk about following historical and scholarly consensus and talk about checking things, don't do that when it comes to a lot of these historical ideas. And the other thing that bothered me is that no one else was calling this out. So there's no shortage of people who will call out Christians when they do this stuff. There's no shortage of people who will call out Christians when they do this stuff when it comes to science, but also when it comes to history. But no one was standing up and saying, actually, guys, no, that's wrong. And eventually it got to the point where I sort of said, well, okay, maybe I need to be that guy. So now I'm that guy. And very annoying to a hell of a lot of atheists as a result, to the extent that many of them actually believe that I'm not an atheist. And I've been called everything from a closet Christian to, and this is the one I love, a paid shill of the Vatican, which I've a badge I wear with pride. I actually came across this on a blog. It was like, this guy, Tim O'Neill, he's a paid Vatican shill. I thought, paid, really? I haven't seen a red cent from those bastards in Rome, but it would be nice. If the Pope is listening to your podcast, it would be nice if he sent me a check.
Yeah, and I wouldn't mind a Patreon donation from him either. And as I told you last time, I think a paid Vatican operative would be a great subtitle to a resume.
Yeah, that's right. Paid, that's what it was. It was paid Vatican operative. I was an operative, which I think is hilarious. I also, when I'm looking at my blog, I look at the links that track back to my blog, but also look at the search terms that track back to my blog, and I quite often come across Tim O'Neill fake atheist, Tim O'Neill really a Christian? I've yet to come across Tim O'Neill paid Vatican operative, but I still wear that one with pride. That's great.
Absolutely fantastic. And I know once again we're being a little redundant, but this will be the first time that someone who's not us has heard this conversation. So as two history nerds, yourself being focused a lot on the Middle Ages, as I told you before, I'm kind of a 19th century history nerd. Yeah. Do you think a lot of these myths are so popular because they fit an agenda? Yeah. Or do you think they're just easier to digest when one side's good, one side's bad, and it's easy?
Yeah, it's both. First of all, yes, it's an agenda. People tend to like stories, but also people tend to like stories that confirm what they believe. And it's hard for us to fight against confirmation bias. So if you hear a story that actually fits with what you think about something, such as Christians burned down the Great Library of Alexandria because they hated science and knowledge, then it's hard to actually dislodge that idea. You tend to look for evidence that backs that up, or you just don't bother to look for the evidence at all. But the other thing is that a lot of these historical or pseudo-historical myths actually do resolve themselves into nice, neat little fables. So, you know, the Galileo one, for example. Once upon a time, there was a man called Galileo, and he was rational and wise and scientific. But the Catholic Church came along, and he said that he proved that the Earth went around the sun. But the Catholic Church came along, and it was evil and irrational and superstitious and hated science. And so they tortured him, or they put him in jail, or they threatened to burn him at the stake. And so he had to back down. But he was right, they were wrong, and therefore science is good and religion is bad, and we all lived happily ever after. That's a beautiful story, right? It's a lovely story. Like many fairy tales, it's got a beginning and a middle and an end. It's got villains. It's got a hero. It's got a happy ending. It's fantastic. Problem is, it's crap. And unfortunately, history is messy and complicated and confusing, and it doesn't actually resolve itself into nice little moral fables. So people prefer moral fables and get quite upset when annoying bastards like me come along and say, I'm sorry, but that story's garbage, and get very angry with me, and therefore, you know, call me a Vatican operative and all that stuff.
Right, and I know it's different in America here. The teaching of history is often given a bit of a slanted bias, and James Lowen has published several books about that. Lies My Teacher Told Me, Lies Across America, and things like that. And the Galileo story, I know you've been into this before, but because we weren't able to go through it, can we go back to that? Sure. And can you sort of recount it and dispel the myth, if you will?
Okay. Well, again, as I just said, history is complicated, and so it would actually take me an enormous amount of time to tell the real story. And this is the thing, you know, the fable, the crap version, is easier to tell. But I suppose the key point is first of all, that Galileo did not prove that the Earth went around the sun. He made some arguments, some of which were very good, and some of which were very bad and were wrong. But he didn't actually prove it. And in the early 17th century, there were actually about seven competing models for what was going on in the cosmos.
Seven. Wow.
Only one of them was actually geocentric. That was the Ptolemaic model. And that had been accepted by the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, and therefore by the medieval church and everyone else, up until around about the time that Galileo came along. And that was the only one that had actually been debunked. And it was debunked by Galileo using his telescope and observing the phases of Venus and the mountains on the moon and so on. He basically said, all right, particularly the phases of Venus, that means Ptolemy must be wrong. But it's not like that means Ptolemy must be wrong, therefore Copernicus must be right, because there were all these other competing models. There was another heliocentric model, not the Copernican one, that was come up with by Kepler, and that actually turned out to be the one closest to be true. Galileo rejected it, and so Galileo actually rejected the one model that was actually kind of right. He accepted Copernicus's model, which was largely wrong. It was right about the sun being at the center. It was just completely wrong about everything else, you know, circular orbits and epicycles, all this stuff, complete garbage. So Galileo did not prove that Copernicus was right, largely because Copernicus was wrong. he was right about the Earth being going around the Sun. He was wrong about everything else. Then there were all these other models, and probably the main one, which at that time, with Ptolemy's model having been debunked, the main one that everyone was largely accepting, and when by everyone I mean scientists here, was the Tychonian model, which was a geoheliocentric model, which basically said the Sun goes around the Earth, but all the other planets are going around the Sun. That sounds weird to us. In fact, that sounds crazy to us. But it actually fitted the observations at the time, and unlike the Copernican model, it didn't violate physics. Now, we now know the physics of the time was wrong, but we know that because we're post Newton, and Newton wasn't born when Galileo was talking about this stuff.
Right.
Newton didn't publish his Principia Mathematica until about 90 years after Galileo. And it wasn't until Newton came along and completely changed physics and said, actually, Aristotelian physics is wrong, here's what's actually going on, that was put together with Kepler's three laws of planetary motion, and we came up with the largely correct model of what was happening. Galileo did not see any of that happen, because it all happened after he died. So if we look at things, at what was happening in the early 17th century, at the time of Galileo's trial, the overwhelming consensus of science, let's forget about religion, the overwhelming consensus of science was that Galileo was wrong. Almost everyone, with the exception of about 10 people in the whole of Europe, almost everyone agreed that heliocentrism was wrong. So the Catholic Church was not illiterate in science, was not ignorant, was not relying purely on superstition and biblical literalism. It had science on its side, and it said so. In the condemnation of Galileo, they said, your theory is absurd in philosophy and formally heretical. Absurd in philosophy means scientifically wrong. And then there's a semicolon. This is actually important. There's a semicolon, then says, and formally heretical. The two things are distinct, separate, but connected. The reason they're saying it's formally heretical is because it's also absurd in philosophy. It's scientifically incorrect. So they actually thought they had the science of the day on their side, because they did. It wasn't until 90 years later that they realized actually the scientific consensus was wrong. Now, this completely changes the story, because the story is they hated science and they were scientifically stupid and so on. They weren't. They had science on their side, and they were very confident, rightly so, that they were right, and that Galileo was a crackpot. It's a different story, you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think part of it is that the overall myth of the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, being a repressed, scientific-free era, and that a whole bunch of them were burned at the stake. And, of course, I remember you said that you've asked people many times to name one scientist that was burned at the stake for science, right?
Yeah, this is kind of one of my party tricks. Whenever anyone starts talking about how the medieval church suppressed science, I say, give me one example. From the Middle Ages is generally defined as from about 500 AD to about 1500 AD. So give me one example from that period of anyone being burnt at the stake for anything to do with science. Give me one example of anyone being imprisoned, being suppressed, being spoken to harshly, being looked at in an unkind way for anything to do with science in that period. I've been asking people to do that for 35 years, and no one has been able to give me a single example. Because it...
Because there aren't any.
Because it didn't happen. And it's really funny watching people thrashing around trying to come up with, they suppress science. Okay, give me an example. They can't. What they always do is they usually fall back on Galileo, who wasn't in the Middle Ages anyway. I mean, the Galileo trial was 1616. He was a contemporary of Descartes, so, not medieval. Or they say, oh, well, because they were so good at suppressing science, there was no scientists in the period for them to burn, which is kind of crazy. And then I say, okay, then explain to me why the following people who did scientific work in the Middle Ages weren't burned at the stake. Explain to me why Jean Buridan, Nicole Doresme, why Albrecht of Saxony, why Albertus Magnus, Robert Grosseteste, why Theodoric of Freiburg, or Roger Bacon, or Thierry of Chartres, or Gerbert of Aureliac, or William of Conches, or I could go on and on and on. These guys were all doing work in... They were doing work in physics, they were doing work in chemistry, they were doing work in anatomy, all in the Middle Ages. So where does the idea that there was no science in the Middle Ages come from? It basically comes from the 19th century. In the 19th century, what we saw was a reaction against the Christian response to Darwin. And what you had, particularly in America... I'm afraid we're going to have to blame you for this. But what happened in...
Okay, sorry. We did it again.
We blame you for this and Trump. But
oh, well, we can blame everything on Trump. That's fine with me.
Well, that's fine. But effectively what happened was, yeah, Darwin came along. There was this huge reaction in America, particularly in the Protestant, evangelical Protestant sphere, against Darwin, because it was very threatening. And what effectively you got was this sort of fundamentalist reaction to modernism, as they called it generally. And then there was a reaction to that. So there was this sort of free thinker reaction by largely American non-believers who projected that conflict between religion and science. They projected it back into history. And so what we've got is some people who came up with the idea that religion has always been in conflict with science, and religion has always been trying to repress science and restrict scientific ideas. And this is what's called the Draper-White thesis. It's also called the conflict thesis. It was first promulgated by John William Draper and by Andrew Dixon White, who were two American writers, neither of them historians. But Wright published a book called The History of Warfare, The Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom in 1896. And he really sort of came up with this idea that science has always been trying to sort of... religion has always been trying to repress science. And a lot of these myths that I'm talking about began with Draper and White. Historians of science have rejected the Draper-White thesis for about a century. And they absolutely reject the idea that science has always been repressed by religion. They note that there have been conflicts between religion and science, and Darwin... And evolution is one clear example. They also note that there have been cases where the two have kind of butted heads, and we could say that the Galileo case is one of those. But a lot of the stuff that Draper and White held up as examples of religion repressing science turned out to be complete myths. You know, like the medieval church saying that the earth was flat never happened. But Draper and White kind of made that up. And it's
right, because that goes back to the Greeks, and yeah. Usually when you point that out, they'll say something like, after Rome fell, then they covered that up, or something ridiculous like that. Like there was this massive flat Earth conspiracy.
Yeah, that's right. That's the story. Now we can actually blame again. I'm afraid another American. We can actually blame an American novelist for this one.
That was Washington Irving, right?
Washington Irving, the guy who wrote the Legend of Sleepy Hollow. He wrote a novel in 1828. I'm just checking this. Yeah, about Columbus. He was actually commissioned by his publishers to write a novel about Columbus. It was on one of the anniversaries of Columbus's so-called discovery of America, and he was given advance, which is something that authors always like, and he was given the brief, write a novel about Columbus. So he sat down and started researching Columbus, and what he found actually was that Columbus wasn't very interesting at all. It wasn't a very dramatic voyage. He sailed from Spain, they sailed, and then they got to America. That's kind of boring. So because the idea behind fiction is you've got to have conflict, there is no drama without conflict. So he made up a conflict. He invented the idea that the Earth, that the Catholic Church taught that the Earth was flat. He invented the idea that Columbus said that they were wrong, and then proved that they were wrong by sailing supposedly over the horizon and not falling off the edge of the flat Earth. Great story again. You know, you've got Columbus, he's a hero, and you've got the Catholic Church, everyone hates them, and you know, he was right and they were wrong, and also he was like the first American. So it's a terrific story. As a result, the book became a bestseller. Everyone now knows, in inverted commas, that the Catholic Church taught the Earth was flat, and everyone knows that despite the fact it's complete garbage.
Inciting Incident couldn't keep bringing you commentary, interviews, and fantastic guests without help from you, the patrons. You can support the podcast on a monthly basis at patreon.com/incitingincident, which gives you access to many great rewards, including a free t-shirt if you pledge $5 or more. You can also support the show by subscribing, rating, reviewing, and commenting. To contact them about ideas, guests, disagreements, fisticuffs, salmon slapping, rebel rousing, or just plain old tomfoolery, you can email them at incitingincidentpodcast@gmail.com. On Facebook at facebook.com/incitingincidentpodcast, or yell into a tin cup and hope it's connected to one of our aforementioned string networks. And now, back to the show.
And what's to be gained from these myths? I mean, I know it sort of backs up the new atheist agenda to point out how religion has always been wrong about science and there's always been that conflict, but when you get past that, you know, even if all of that was true, it wouldn't change what's going on right now. So what is the benefit to perpetuating these myths about history that seems to make atheists so planted in defending them?
It makes us feel good. It makes us feel good. It makes us, you know, it makes us feel smug and superior, and it's fun to hit Christianity over the head. Look, I'm more than happy to hit Christianity over the head about stuff that's actually true. My problem is so-called rationalists who don't talk about checking their facts, hitting Christianity over the head about stuff that's wrong. And you know, call me weird, but I actually think if you say you're going to be rational and you're going to check your facts and you're going to look at the evidence, so I think you should actually do that. You know, crazy idea.
Yeah, I've always found that knowing what happened is a much better way to know what happened. I don't know about anybody else, but...
This is the thing. The real story is always much more interesting. Right, the real story is much more interesting. So, this is the other reason why I get into this stuff, because I usually find that when you look at stuff that people understand about history, you usually find one that it's wrong. And I'm not just talking about new atheist bad history, as I call it. I'm talking about conceptions about history generally. You usually find what people think is true is wrong, and you find that what actually happened is much more fascinating than the bald story. So take the story of the Great Library of Alexandria, for example. You know, another classic new atheist myth. It was the Great Library of Alexandria, and it was the most important library in the world, and it was a great repository of all knowledge. And the ancient Greeks and Romans were on the brink of a scientific revolution, but then along came Christianity, and they burned the Great Library of Alexandria down because they hated science. And so all that knowledge was lost, and we were plunged into 1,000 years of dark ages until the glorious Renaissance dawned and everyone became smart again and the scientific revolution happened and we were all rescued from superstition and ignorance. And we all lived happily ever after. Again, it's a beautiful story. It's just complete garbage. But what did happen is much more interesting. What did happen is that there wasn't just one... I mean, seriously... one library in the whole of the ancient world? Really? That just doesn't make any sense at all. So of course the Great Library did exist, and yes, it was a great repository of all sorts of interesting stuff, and it would be fantastic if every single book that ever existed in it still existed. I'm a historian of the ancient world. I'd love for all that stuff to still be there. Unfortunately, all of the libraries, plural, in the ancient world, they all got destroyed at some point, or declined, or burned down, or fell apart. But it's not like there was one great library in the whole of the ancient world. There was the Great Library of Pergamon, which was the rival of the Great Library of Alexandria. They hated each other, which is really, it's really quite funny. It's like, you know, rival universities these days. And there's a story, it's just a story, but I love it. There's a story that the Great Library of Alexandria hated the guys there, hated the guys in the Great Library of Pergamon so much that they stopped exporting papyrus from Egypt so that the Great Library of Pergamon couldn't write any more books. And so the Great Library of Pergamon went, all right, stuff you, and they invented parchment. So they said, all right, we'll write on something else, and they invented parchment. They scraped animal skins and bleached them and used those for writing books instead, and that's how parchment was invented. Almost certainly total nonsense.
But so that's kind of like the American Republicans' version of if we can't win elections, we'll just make sure they can't vote, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But there were many libraries. Of course, there were many libraries across the ancient world. There was one in Ephesus, the Great Library of Celsus. There were many in Rome, thousands actually in Rome. There were libraries in public baths. There were libraries in temples and so on. So the idea that one library was the only repository of all scientific knowledge in the ancient world, that you just have to think about that for like a second and realize that that's obviously garbage. The idea that the ancient Greeks were on the brink of some kind of great scientific revolution, this is nonsense as well. It's a nice story. We could be living on the moon. We could have, you know, rocket ships to Mars if the Great Library didn't burn down. We can blame Carl Sagan, much as I love that guy, but we can blame Carl Sagan for that one. He told that story and people have latched onto it. It's nonsense. The Greeks weren't on the brink of a scientific revolution. People quite often hold up examples like there's a little machine that was found in a shipwreck back in the 1930s called the Antikythera mechanism. And it's this corroded piece of bronze, but it was originally a very complicated, very intricately designed, geared astronomical instrument that basically mapped the heavens. Beautiful little machine. People hold that up and say, look at this. They were clearly highly scientific. They were making these amazingly technical things and therefore something. I don't know. Apparently they were on the brink of inventing warp drives and flying to Alpha Centauri. You look at that, the Antikythera mechanism. Yeah, it's a beautiful little machine. It's a geocentric ori. It's wrong. And also it led nowhere. they invented this thing. We get a reference to it in Archimedes' works, and nothing happened for hundreds of years. This is well before Christianity popped up. So it's not like they were almost going to do these things and then Christianity killed it. Same with people talk about Hero of Alexandria. They talk about the fact that he invented a steam engine. Well, kind of. He invented a little toy that was steam-powered. It went nowhere. They didn't have the metallurgy, they didn't have the mathematics, they didn't have the precision tooling to actually invent proper steam engines. The reason steam engines popped up when they did in the 17th century is that there was a long period where people actually developed the high-stress metallurgy, where they developed the mathematics and they developed the precision tooling, and they also had a reason to make a steam engine. That's when steam engines arose. The ancient Greeks didn't have any of those things. They also didn't have a reason to invent a steam engine because they had millions of slaves. So the idea that the Great Library of Alexandria was burned down by Christians and it set us back and we'd all be living on Mars now, that's garbage. Then there's the fact that the Christians didn't actually burn down the Great Library of Alexandria, a small detail that kind of kills the story. So the Great Library of Alexandria had ceased to exist about a century and a half before Christianity came along. At all, it was substantially, the collection of the Great Library was substantially destroyed by Julius Caesar back in the BCs. That was around about in the middle of the first century BC. He accidentally, he didn't mean to, but he was laying siege to Alexandria, and his soldiers accidentally burnt down some warehouses that housed most of the collection of the Great Library. Oops. And that from that point on, the Great Library was really in severe decline. But what was left of the Great Library was actually destroyed in the 270s by the Roman Emperor Aurelian, who again was laying siege to Alexandria, and ended up burning down most of the royal quarter, the main part of the city, which included the museum and the Great Library. And so that was the end. That was the end of the Great Library. So what are people referring to when they say Christians burned down the Great Library of Alexandria? They're referring to a daughter library that was outside of the royal quarter in the Temple of Serapis, the Serapium, that did house a large collection of books, not millions of books, but a few thousand. And that was the last remnant of the Great Library of Alexandria. Problem is, Christians didn't burn that down either.
Oh, jeez.
Right? So what actually happened there was you had the Serapium. It did have a collection of books, and it had a collection of books right into the 4th century, so into the period where Christianity was dominant in the Roman Empire. The Serapium was torn down by Roman soldiers and a mob of Christians in the late 4th century. But it didn't... The evidence indicates that it didn't have a library at that point. The library had ceased to exist. The books have been sold off or basically been looted in some earlier uprisings in the city. So when the Christians tore down the Serapium, it seems that there wasn't actually a library there. We know this because there are 5 accounts of the destruction of the Serapium, 2 of which are hostile, very hostile against Christians, one by Eunapius of Sardis, who was an anti-Christian pagan philosopher. He talks about what idiots the Christians were. He says that they were like beasts. He says they were barbarians. What he doesn't say is, oh, and by the way, they destroyed the last remnant of the Great Library of Alexandria. Small detail that you think he might mention if that happened. We actually have a reference, though, to the Serapium before it was torn down by a guy called Ammianus Marcellinus, who was a pagan historian, writing in around about the mid-4th century. And he talks about what a magnificent temple it was. And it seems that he actually went to Alexandria and he saw it. It seems like it's a first-hand account. But he talks about the library and he uses the past tense. He says its colonnades have housed great libraries. So he uses the past tense. So it seems that by the time Ammianus got there, the libraries were gone. And then when we get the account of the destruction of the temple, it seems that the temple was already derelict and partly in ruins, so it's pretty unlikely that there was a functioning library there. And then we get the Christians tearing it down. The other thing that doesn't get mentioned when people talk about Christians destroying the Serapium or destroying the library in the Serapium is why the Christians were actually tearing the place down in the first place. It's because it was being used as a hideout by a group of pagan terrorists who were using it as their base, going out into the streets, dragging Christians back there and torturing them to death. That bit doesn't get told, which I think is interesting.
Definitely, definitely. So, like I said, I could listen to you talk about this stuff all day, but, you know, we of course have a limited amount of time, but we're not there yet. But what I do want to ask is throw some of the new atheists a bone here, and what's some of the history that Christians made up? I'm just curious, since we've been focused on, you know, the false history that atheists have. What's one that goes the other way?
Oh, there's so much. Because you know, it works the other way as well. Those guys have exactly the same sort of problems with confirmation bias. But I think, you know, there's a couple that spring to mind. I suppose the one that often gets used is this argument, which is a really bad argument, but it's an argument that Jesus must have risen from the dead because the disciples all got martyred. They were all killed for their faith. They believed that Jesus rose from the dead. No one would die for a belief that they know is false, so they couldn't have been making it up because they were all killed, and so therefore Jesus did rise from the dead. Can you see a problem with that argument?
Yeah, I think I can see a few.
Okay, so the first problem is we don't know what the disciples actually believed about Jesus' resurrection. It's pretty clear that they believed that he rose from the dead, but when you look at the evidence, it's not clear that they believe what modern Christians believe. That's that Jesus physically, you know, stood up in the tomb, looked at the holes in his hands and his side and thought, wow, I'm alive. They seem to have believed that in some sense that he rose from the dead, but that seems to be based on visions, on apparitions. So we've got Paul saying, yeah, I saw the risen Jesus, but he seems to be referring to some vision that he saw. So it seems that the early belief in Jesus' resurrection was much more about visions. And the whole idea of a physical resurrection actually came about later on. So when we get the, when you look at the gospel stories about the resurrection, they're completely contradictory because they seem to have kind of evolved. So it seems to have been a story growing in the telling. That's problem number one. Problem number two, the idea that all of the disciples who supposedly witnessed the risen Jesus died for their faith is actually on very, very shaky foundations. Most of the stories that we have about the martyrdom of those disciples date from the 2nd, 3rd, or even 4th centuries, and they're totally contradictory stories. So Thomas, doubting Thomas, apparently got martyred in India, unless, of course, you believe the story that says he was martyred in Armenia, or the one that says that he was martyred in Persia. And the stories about how he was martyred differ as well. These are clearly legends. So the idea that all the disciples were martyred for their faith, when you actually poke at that and say, okay, where's the evidence for that? The evidence turns out to be pretty insubstantial and almost certainly nonsense. So that is a classic example of Christian bad history. And there are many, many other examples of that. Christians are about as bad at history as they are at science.
That makes total sense. And, you know, there's, of course, the modern day myths that perpetuate the church and, you know, a lot of the ones that get passed around on memes on Facebook. So I'll save you from having to dissect some of those because most of them are just utter shit. So if we look at the modern day and we look at the strength of the rhetoric and the strength of our ability to learn, what's the best way to dispel myths of history and get at the actual knowledge? What's the, you know, I know it's not easy, but what's the best way to do that?
Well, unfortunately, there's no easy way, and it means doing a bit of hard work, and that's one of the reasons why it doesn't happen that much. I think probably the best thing to do is actually pay attention to the experts. And we atheists do this when we're talking about science. We say to creationists, look, there's this huge consensus of people who have been devoting their lives to this stuff. And we're not making an argument from authority here, but we're noting that these people, surely these people aren't all wrong. So we do that quite a bit when it comes to science. We should do it when it comes to history as well. So there is a very popular idea amongst many atheists, and I can see why it's popular, that there was no historical Jesus at all, and that Jesus was purely a myth, and so Christianity is obviously stupid and wrong. And I can see why that's popular. It's a much bigger stick to thump Christianity over the head with, to say that Jesus didn't exist at all, compared to saying Jesus was just a Jewish preacher. But the overwhelming consensus of scholars is that there was a historical Jesus. Now, I know that's not fun, and I can see why the mythic Jesus idea is much more popular, but there's a good reason why the historians agree that there probably was a historical Jesus. So I think probably the best thing to do is actually pay attention. Don't take it as gospel, excuse the pun, but pay attention to what the experts are saying, and pay attention to who is making claims. You know, if you look at a website that's called JesusDidn'tExist.com and it's written by some crazy guy in Wales, and he's got no historical qualifications whatsoever, and he kind of reads a bit like a bit of a nut, there's a good chance that guy's a bit of a nut, even though he might be saying things that you like and that sound true and that feel good. I think it's better to actually look at someone who is, say, I don't know, maybe a professor of Judaic studies at the University of Oxford, like the late Geza Vermes, who says, yep, Jesus existed. I think it's more likely to sort of kind of go with a Jewish scholar of ancient history than some nut in Wales. Just my feeling.
Well, I personally get all my history from David Icke because, you know, the lizard people are really what was behind everything that ever happened. They took over the minds of all the great people and have been running the world. But that's besides the point. I've noticed this recent fascination with the Jesus is a myth thing. And I think part of it I know it's going to be debated at the Myth Information Conference because a lot of the skeptic podcasters recently have been promoting that. But is there something recent that has sort of brought that on, or is it just like the rest of these historical things we're talking about, it furthers an agenda?
Yeah, pretty much the latter. And I think it's been interesting because like I first came across the idea of the Jesus myth thesis many, many years ago when I first started studying the origins of Christianity and the whole sort of debate about the so-called historical Jesus. So we should stress we're not talking about, when I talk about Jesus existing, I'm not talking about Jesus Christ, right? I'm not talking about the figure of Christianity, that's central to Christianity, or the figure that's in the Gospels. I'm talking about a Jewish preacher, Yeshua Bar Yosef, who was probably, most likely, the point of origin for those stories, right? So we're not, when I say Jesus existed, I'm not saying the guy who walked on water and rose from the dead. I'm talking about a Jewish preacher who probably believed that the end of the world was coming in his lifetime. So I first came across this many, many years ago, and because there was a kind of Jesus myth debate back in the late 19th, early 20th century amongst scholars, and generally, basically what happened was the scholars looked at that idea and thought, hey, maybe this guy didn't exist at all. Let's examine the evidence. And they came to the conclusion that, yeah, that doesn't work. It seems that he did. And so they moved on. So when I first came across the Jesus myth idea, it was basically, yeah, there was this theory at one point that some people argued, but on the whole, everyone's kind of decided that's probably wrong. Then it started popping up again. And the interesting thing is it started popping up at around about the time the internet really started to take off. So I remember in about the late mid-1990s or late 1990s, about 97, 98, I started seeing it again. I thought, oh, that's interesting. That idea is popping up. And it was coming up in the same sort of forums where you'd see stuff about David Icke and the lizard people and Holocaust denial. It was this crazy sort of fringe idea that the kind of people who believed in conspiracy theories were promulgating. Then I started seeing it popping up on atheist discussion boards, and then it really took off. So it's interesting that what's happened is that it seems to have been a bit of an internet phenomenon, and I think that's where it's kind of gotten legs. What hasn't happened, and despite the fact that people like Richard Carrier say that there's a growing movement among scholars to believe that Jesus didn't exist, there isn't. You can count the number of actual scholars who believe it on the finger of one hand. But there certainly is a growing movement of believing that amongst online atheists. And I think it's an internet idea, which is a bit weird.
It really is. And history itself is just fascinating for all the ways that people come up to deny things that happened. Like, I know you mentioned Holocaust denial in there, and some of the stuff we're talking about here goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, but things that happened where people are still alive from them, like it's almost like those people who think that every mass shooting was somehow orchestrated by the government. It's just silly.
Yeah, and this is the other thing. When I talk about why people believe some of these things, some of it is that people are basically ignorant of history, and that's fair enough. Not everyone is going to do what I do and spend hours and hours reading academic texts on this stuff, but I think some of it is also that people kind of like being contrarians. They like being and this is where a lot of conspiracy theory comes from, they like being the one who has kind of come up with the secret knowledge, who understands something that most people don't know, and there's a certain smugness to a lot of, particularly the Jesus myth guys, like, you fools, you all think that Jesus existed. I am the wise one who has shown that all the scholars are wrong. So you get a lot of the people who write about that stuff who've got this very sort of superior attitude. People like Dave Fitzgerald, who wrote that book Nailed, which is terrible. It's a piece of garbage. But lots of people read that and they think, wow, I'm now privy to secret knowledge. It's one of the reasons why the Da Vinci Code was a bestseller. despite the fact it's one of the worst written novels in the history of humanity. because it convinced a lot of people that they were suddenly privy to a lot of secret background knowledge, and that feels good. So I can see that, I understand the psychology of contrarianism, but that doesn't make excuses for being stupid and wrong.
I absolutely loved when everybody started suddenly becoming a skeptic about the Da Vinci Code. That was a fascinating time, especially with all the Catholics here who were protesting it as if they were saying it was a documentary. Yeah. The same thing happened with Dogma back when that came out. So it was just silly all around.
Kind of, but what we're going to remember, and I actually wrote a website called History versus the Da Vinci Code, because again, the Da Vinci Code was incredibly annoying to someone like me, because I remember people saying to me, oh, you love history, you should read this book. And after a while I thought, okay, I'll read the bloody thing. I read it in an afternoon, because let's face it, you'd have to have the reading age of about a 7-year-old pot plant to not be able to read it quickly. Have you read it? Have you read the book?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh.
Absolutely.
I have.
It's candy floss. It's like the most insubstantial piece of nonsense. I did actually literally throw it at the wall at a couple of points, though, because this guy could not have got more wrong if he tried. There isn't a single piece of reference to anything in history in that entire novel that he doesn't get wrong. It's astonishing. It's almost like he was trying to. But then people were sort of...
Sorry.
That's okay. But then people were sort of saying, oh, wow, it's all true. And then, yeah, you had the Catholic reaction, obviously, saying, well, no, it's not. But the thing is, Dan Brown did claim that it was all true, repeatedly. That was part of the marketing that made the whole thing into an international bestseller. He repeatedly claimed that it's all true. If you look at page one of the book, it says... First word in the novel is fact, and then there's this list of stuff
Wow. That
he's claiming is true. Every single one of these things in this list of facts is wrong, completely wrong. So this is kind of where I began my career as a paid Vatican operative, because here I was an atheist, and I found myself arguing against this stupid book. And defending the Catholic Church. And while I was doing it, I was thinking, God, this is ridiculous. I mean, anyone who knows me knows I think the Catholic Church is ludicrous. I mean, I'm an ex-Catholic, for Christ's sake. But just because they're Catholics doesn't mean they're wrong about everything. And this is something I think we atheists need to remember. Just because a Christian apologist says something doesn't mean they're actually... therefore, they're automatically wrong. If they say the sky is blue, that could mean that the sky is actually blue. Just because they say that Jesus rose from the dead doesn't mean everything they say is actually incorrect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I apologize if I've cut you off a couple of times. I think there is a bit of a delay between us, so hopefully that comes out okay. The Da Vinci Code, before it was a Tarantino movie, I think is the living definition of pulp fiction. It was just, you know, brainless shit designed to get a lot of people reading it, and it was marketed really well. The book itself is absolute garbage, like you said.
I think we can agree on that. So check out historyversusthedavincicode.com. That was the website I made a few years ago. It looks a bit dated now, but I got sick of telling people, no... The Emperor Constantine didn't put the Bible together at the Council of Nicaea. The Catholic Church didn't suppress the idea that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. All of this stuff. It's a fun book. It's just complete nonsense.
All right, and like you said, I could go on with this stuff all day, but we are running out of time. Before I ask you the final question, I'm going to give you a second chance on the silly hyperbolic question I asked you last time. So now that you've had a week to consider it, if there was one myth or story that you know to be complete bullshit, I know you said that the truth is always more interesting, but if there was one, which one would it be? Would you like it to be true?
Still struggling with this one, Al. I really am. Because bad history just sort of grinds my gears. I can't think of a single thing that I would like to be true. I'm sorry. I'm going to pass on that one. I just...
It's all right. And
if it's wrong...
I gave you my... Go ahead.
Yeah, if it's wrong, it's wrong, you know.
Okay, so, you know, I gave you the example last time, which is my favorite thing I wish were true, which was the Aztec belief that the entire world exists on the back of a crocodile, and that the end of the world will come when the crocodile decides to go underwater. And it's a nice story, but it certainly puts all of our troubles into some sort of perspective.
Yeah, I like that one. I'll go with that one, too.
Okay, we'll go with that. So, last question. You, of course, can be followed at historyforatheist.blogspot.com. We definitely all should go to that site and support it. I've visited it myself, and I've really enjoyed your work, really enjoyed your appearance on Thomas Smith's podcast, and I hope to have you back again, because this was not nearly enough time to go through all the stuff we did, even if it was the second time in a row. So, my final question is, as an Australian who occasionally gets to see some of our best and brightest members of Bullshit Mountain over here in America, what's your best advice to Americans who think they know history, even if they're atheists, and don't? What should they do to be more informed? And I know one of the answers is obviously read primary sources, but if you could be the smug bastard you claim to be and just tell it like it is.
I just think it's just a matter of follow the experts. There are people who devote their lives to this stuff, and they work in peer-reviewed environments, and they don't always agree, and they're not always completely unbiased, but on the whole, the way history works is historians try to convince their peers of what is most likely to have happened in the past. That's the way history works. No one proves anything. But if a consensus comes about on a particular topic, there's probably a good reason for that. So if most historians, and they do, believe that the church didn't oppress Galileo because they hated science, that's probably true. If most historians believe that Jesus probably, historical Jesus probably did exist, that's probably true. So follow the evidence for sure, but pay attention to the experts. And just because you like an idea and it appeals to you emotionally, that's not a rational reason to accept it. Question your emotions. That's what we rationalists are meant to do.
You mean to tell me that we can learn stuff by listening to people who know stuff and agree on things? That's just ridiculous. We don't do that in America. Come on.
That are a book learning. Read books. I think it's probably read more books. You should read more. I think that's probably my advice.
And absolutely.
And vote Hillary, for fuck's sake.
Oh, trust me. We had that conversation on the episode that'll air today, and she may be flawed and corrupt, but she's running against a clinically insane sociopath. So we're doing all we can over here.
Believe me, the rest of the world is looking at you and saying, "What the hell is going on over there?" we are astonished, and honestly, we need you to not vote for that dickhead.
I'm doing the absolute best I can with this podcast, so hopefully we can all look back on this in a year and laugh, or instead of cry. So, Tim, I really want to thank you for coming on the show again. This was just as much fun this time around, and I'd love to have you back on again. Thankfully, this one actually recorded, so we'll be releasing it soon.
Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm more than happy to have done it twice, even if it did mean getting up very early in the morning. Well, what I would say, though, is a lot of people are going to be listening to this and they're going to hear me say stuff. And, yeah, I've got a reasonably sort of dry and flippant, possibly sarcastic way of saying things. But a lot of people are going to listen to what I'm saying and say, "I disagree with that." And they might have other views and other perspectives. Fine. I'm going to put a link to this podcast up on my blog. The comments section is there for a reason. I don't suffer fools gladly. And if you come to me with bullshit, I'll kick your ass. But I'm more than happy for people to comment on this if they have questions or if they have a counter view. I think that's how rationalism works, yeah?
Definitely. And we have a high level of engagement with our listeners and our patrons. So I certainly hope if anybody has a problem or has a dispute or just wants to talk more awesome history, that they'll come to your blog. And I'll certainly link it in the show notes here. Cool. So thanks very much. And I will send you a link so you can link us. And let's do this again sometime on a different topic or at least a different era. What do you say?
Absolutely. It's been good fun. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Tim. We'll talk soon.
That was my bye.
Driving up toward Green Bay, the east. The sun's in the rearview mirror. We both had some pretty tough weeks. White knuckles try to steer. A few more miles, there's no telling what we'll find. All we gotta do is take a little time. We all gotta find our own ways to love and hope and breathe again. For some that just happens to be on the shores of Lake Michigan. You can't explain the way a city grips your mind. All we gotta do is take a little time for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. Waves flow right in and hair rocks that vanish from our sight. Kinda like those troubles that wash away quicker in the moonlight. This crazy old world's got no reason or rhyme. All we gotta do is take a little time for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. To no chance for all that stormy weather, no. It appears conditions won't get much better for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. Sometimes this old world seems much worse than it should be. A couple days later, you're sitting and thinking how lovely. I won't question the scope or design. All I gotta do is take a little time for you and me. Michigan.